sitting here.
Yeah, he.
You're talking about the potential for a pedestrian underpass. Do we need TA care if you put underpasses up in the highways? Is this a major drama?
Yes, they care, but no, it's not a major drama. It is under the highways, it becomes their asset. So they take a close interest in exactly what is being proposed, and of course you can't really work within the highway reserve without their permission anyway. But the installation of an underpass is a very basic engineering problem or issue, and it's well known in terms of what you do. Essentially you close the highway down to one traffic lane, dig a big hole, put a square concrete box in that big hole, put the traffic lane back over the top, and then do the same on the other side. So it's quite common procedural process that's followed. Happens quite well actually for dairy farms that traditionally have had to cross the highway. If you travel from our State Highway 1, you'd see a number of culverts or underpasses that are put in place for the movement of cows from one side of the road to the other. So it requires NTA's permission essentially.
So for instance, as well, LMS has got one just down the road. Next question. Given the safety issues that you've discussed, why not an underpass cut?
Firstly, I don't think it's warranted in terms of my assessment of the safety issues. Secondly, at this stage, it's uncertain that there would be a heavy vehicle movement between the two sides of the site. But thirdly, it would be technically possible to put one in the future if the demand was there. And cars have a different requirement to trucks, and so the first thing you need to do is determine whether you're going to get heavy vehicles underneath as well, in which case you're digging down for 4.5 metres rather than cars at 2.5 metres. But in terms of the technical issues, it would be possible to put an underpass in there for cars. It's just my assessment to show that it's not necessary for the type of development that's being looked at for the moment.
And in terms of the safety measures that you've identified, auxiliary lanes,
yeah.
Presumably, again, that's a matter for NZTA.
Yes.
And similarly, is this a matter of NZTA have to do it, or they have to approve it, and you do it? Well, Mr. Bell would do it in this case.
The way that NZTA usually work is that they like to retain control over who does what on the highway. They've been caught out before by people saying that they'll do things and not or not do them to the appropriate standards. So what would happen in terms of the process would be that NZTA would determine that this was required. They would then appoint their highway managers, big organisations like OPUS or MWH or those sorts of organisations. They would design it, which Mr. Bell would pay for that design. It would then be costed, Mr. Bell would pay for that costing, and then the contract would be let, and Mr. Bell would pay NZTA the right amount of money before the work was then carried out. So NZTA would do the work, but the paymaster is appointed to Mr. Bell.
Yes, I'm familiar with that characteristic of NZTA. They're very happy to swallow someone else's pay.
Yes.
In terms of the safety assessment, my instinctive issue reading your description is that however you configure the road, the cars, the heavy traffic coming out of Mount Barker Road from this site, going back across the line of traffic travelling at 100k, that the rest of the game will have a significant speed disparity.
Yeah.
With the rest of it, they're going to get rear-ended.
And that's the reason for the auxiliary lanes, is because by the time that you build those to the standard that Entertainment require, essentially a heavy vehicle that pulls out of Mount Barker Road to turn right is immediately confronted with the left-turn lane that starts to develop, and so it's not travelling very slowly within the through traffic lane where, right, there's a risk that the a driver who's travelling through doesn't realise that the track in front is travelling more slowly and goes into the back. But with the auxiliary lanes, the truck turns right, it then immediately moves into the left turn auxiliary lane into the airport and away from the through traffic lane. And vice versa, if any vehicle that's moving out of the airport access turns right across the traffic lanes and then into the left turn lane.
And in terms of your discussion of potential traffic movements, how sensitive are these numbers, these percentage, with the total number of total cars to the percentage breakdown? Because, and the reason I'm asking you this is because, given if the use of the site is genuinely for airport related activities, 40% seem low. I would have thought there'd be a stream of traffic between one and the other.
It depends on what it is. I mean, if you were to relocate the control tower, for example, that would have minimal traffic generation. If it's a warehouse, then you'd certainly have movements between the airports and the submitted site. But if those movements were made by heavy vehicles compared to if they were smaller vehicles, there'd be a different traffic effect. The majority of the traffic effect is actually going to be people who are travelling to work. Because if you look at the warehouse and industrial, you have a large floor area, but you don't necessarily have a large traffic generation associated with it for any sort of industrial use or warehousing use. So there will be movements across the highway. It depends upon the nature of the activities as to what that is. I still feel 40% is probably about right. The 880 vehicles, which is the overall threshold, is relatively sensitive. You can see that changing to 920 is sufficient to introduce an additional 10-second delay.
What would the comparable percentage, what would 40% have to move to get to 920? That's it. One side of the line and the other side.
In terms of 880, it is based upon people who are travelling from Wanaka to work and into the site, as well as vehicles that are turning right out of the site and into the airport. The 880 gives the level of certainty on that right turn movement. If you were to, it would be in the order of about 20 vehicles, isn't it? That would increase to, if you wanted to look at a level of service, even found that to be acceptable. This banks of evidence that it isn't, from my experience, level of service isn't really something that Entertainment would willingly accept in a situation like this.
Wish to add something?
Yes, please. My first question is going to your paragraph 30 of your evidence in chief. It is just a clarification. You talked about the most recent information from the NZTA regarding the daily traffic flows and weekly traffic flows. So what was the most recent date? What year were those dates?
2016.
That's 2016. In paragraph 45, you referred to Mr. Brown's advice regarding the extent of the development being in the order of 55 or 1,000 square meters of GFA. just wondering whether there's
spaces
or whether it was a separate conversation.
There was certainly a separate conversation, but I don't know whether that was translated into Mr. McFadden's issue.
Well, what is your understanding of what 55,000 square metres represents?
Well, that then follows through in terms of paragraph 50 of my evidence in chief.
Oh, okay, so we are correct.
So within that 55,000, there's a small cafe, a small visitor accommodation unit, and then ancillary unit, assembly retail, and a 50-50 split for the offices and the warehouse.
Yeah, okay, yes, you're right. What I was really getting at there is that I would, if someone said that sort of floor area to me, one of my immediate responses is that it could represent a decent sized large format retail outlet, just in terms of the overall bulk and so on. Now, you outlined that the mix of activities might include a good portion of warehousing and storage and the like, but as a general concept, do you agree that 55,000 square metres is a pretty substantial sized node of activities?
It's a large number, but firstly, my understanding is that it couldn't become some sort of retail hub because that wouldn't be ancillary to the airport, unless it had a huge increase in passenger numbers. But large warehouses can easily be 10,000 square metres in size. There are some that are being built at Waterloo Business Park, which are enormous. So it isn't necessarily the case that a large floor area immediately translates into a large traffic generation within the context of my effort.
Well, it's a crossover between planning and traffic, I realise, yeah. But in your opinion, does a 10,000 square metre single warehouse a realistic proposition for this particular location?
Well, I haven't. In terms of the traffic generation per 100 square metres, which is what I deal with, it's the same no matter what the size is. I was trying to get some context to that 55,000, where you asked if it was a large area or not.
Sure.
It is a large area, but from my assessment, it's not an out of context large area within the traffic environment.
When you referred to the business park, whereabouts is that?
Waterloo Business Park.
It's
the old Islington Freezing Works. Christchurch towards the southwest of Christchurch.
Oh, so it's not on her, it's not
no,
on
this no.
So how relevant is that?
Well, again, asking whether 55,000 is a large number is a little bit, it doesn't have a context to it. So what I was trying to suggest is that 55,000 in and of itself is perhaps not as meaningful as trying to benchmark it against certain sizes of development that could happen.
All right. Sort of an observation that in your hypothetical development scenario, you didn't mention service station, which I thought might be a credible type of activity on a site in that location. Was it something that you considered?
Well, again, the scenario that I've tested is the one that Mr. Brown has provided to me, so I haven't tried to explore alternative options. So in terms of traffic generation, a service station doesn't generate traffic in its own right. It's pass-by traffic that it attracts. The days of people who make a deliberate trip to the service station that my dad used to do to get petrol sort of passed. So then it would generate vehicle movements into and out of the site. But it wouldn't generate brand new trips on the road.
That said, you've commented at length about the performance of the intersection of Mount Barker Road and the State Highway. So,
yes.
In your opinion, hypothetically speaking, if there were to be a service station, what might that do to the performance of the intersection?
Provided it fits within the 880 vehicle movements in the peak hours, then there wouldn't be an issue. If the service station meant that it tripped over that threshold, then there would potentially be a difficulty. The scenario would be people who were leaving Wanaka to call into the service station to write into North Barker Road. But because they're passed by traffic, so those vehicles would then be turning right out of North Barker Road to continue their journey. And it's that right turn movement which is the most critical in the morning weekend.
Just taking a very conservative scenario for the service station, what range of traffic movements would you anticipate in a typical peak hour?
Traffic generation of a service station is usually between 2% and 5% of the passing traffic. So given the traffic volumes on the road of 340 vehicle movements in the peak hour, which is the critical one for the traffic generation in this instance, I would expect up to 17 vehicles into the service station, 17 vehicles out of the service station.
So that's 34 movements in the hour.
34 movements two way, yeah. Assuming that it track. No, less, isn't it? It's 5% of the 340 is the two way. So that would be 18 two way, so 9 in, 9 out.
It seems rather low, especially in association with an airport where if there were to be some sort of commercial traffic. Rental vehicles. I mean, we're not talking about a Queenstown, we're talking about a smaller, much smaller area. But if there were to be a fleet of rental vehicles and people coming and going, filling up before they return their rental vehicles, I would have thought a bit easily that would allow that.
Well, again, this is the morning peak hour, which is the critical period that we're talking of, and a lot of the flights would be associated with time periods that are not within the peak hours. The peak hours are the critical issue here because of the site providing employment and people travelling to the site for work purposes. Whereas the service station might be generating more traffic at 10 or 11 o'clock in the morning, for example, associated with the flight. But at that point, people are not travelling to and from work, and so the capacity of the network to absorb those vehicle movements is a lot greater.
Turning next to paragraph 57, you talked about the intersection. Do you think that this development occurs on both sides of the state highway, that ultimately some form of traffic speed reduction would be necessary, just based on your overall experience of similar situations elsewhere?
It wouldn't be necessary.
Not necessary.
In my experience, NZTA's remit ultimately is to support economic activity. And how it interprets that in different circumstances varies. In some circumstances, NZTA doesn't permit access to the highway because it sees that the greater good of economic activity is provided for by facilitating the movement of through traffic. And if NZTA took that view in this instance, then it gives freedom of 100, and that's the scenario that I've set. But if NZTA took the view that actually activity around the Monaco Airport area was going to be beneficial, then they would potentially use their discretion to reduce the speed limit 30. But that would be a matter of discretion for them rather than anything that's necessary as part of this.
My understanding is that they will not, under any circumstances, agree to pedestrian crossings, at-grade pedestrian crossings, where the speed limit's 100 kph. Is that what you...
NZTA pedestrian planning guide talks about issues associated with at-grade pedestrian crossings on high-speed roads, and so they would not be anticipating that there will be a large amount of pedestrian movements across the highway under that speed limit.
Yeah. And you talked a bit also about the sensitivity of traffic movements to whether level of service D or E would prevail. What is there the same sensitivity moving from E to F? is that it's from D to E. And what I would like to know is what increase in traffic movement would take level of service E up to level of F without your recommended cap on traffic movements.
That's not a test that I've done, so I can't hand on heart give you an exact number. But I can say that the boundary or the traffic volumes that give rise to the threshold between D and E, and there's quite a large step change to go between there and E to F. So it will be larger than 20, but and I would hazard a guess to say it's going to be about an additional 40 vehicles turning right, but I couldn't hand on heart give you an exact answer because it's not a test that I've done.
Thank you. The chair actually asked a question that I had relating to your son's statement. For paragraph 32, you've referred to where the transport agency considers it with the benefit of reduced speed limit, and touched on that. I actually did wonder whether there had been any discussion briefly between yourself and NZTA on this proposal for rezoning.
There's been nothing personally that I've been involved with, but I don't know whether other people in the team have had conversations or not.
Thank you. That's all.
Going to the intersection, obviously you can tell us how it's going to flow. If you looked at that is going to build. Obviously, it's going to get bigger. And if you looked at 40% of the movements being into site, is there a case for actually looking at the underpass being for that inter-site movement, or some? And an associated question to that: if you're actually going through the motions of putting in a pedestrian underpass, and as you say, it's a relatively easy task, but I'd imagine it would be a massive amount of costs in creating that task. But if you actually looked at the upgrade from and not trucks but pedestrians to small delivery vehicle, golf cart, buggy with bits, is that something that you've considered?
It's not something I have explicitly considered because my analysis is focused on assessing the safety of the intersections and those proposed movements. But you're right in terms of the differential between putting in a pedestrian underpass and putting in a slightly wider pedestrian underpass, which would allow for vehicle flows, will be small in relationship to putting in the underpass in the first place. Generally, you want passes to be a little bit wider than absolutely necessary because it removes a kind of a corridor effect that means pedestrians feel constrained. And so it's really the thought that the pedestrian pass would certainly be able to accommodate one traffic lane anyway. And so if and that may be sufficient for the types of movements that are envisaged. So there may be no additional cost associated with that. If for some reason there was a much higher cross flow across the highway, then widening that out to provide two-way traffic flow might be an option. But it's technically feasible. In this instance, the highway road reserve is 40 metres wide. I don't know why it's 40 metres wide, other than perhaps land was cheap at the time they decided to buy it.
It's good for cyclists.
but at 40 metres, you're only going to be using less than half of that for the road. So that gives you a huge amount of space on both sides that are straightforward to put in steps or ramps to underpasses. So it only actually requires NZTA's permission and NZTA's land to do this sort of thing.
Thank you. How long is Mr. Brown's summary? Should we Japan, as the name of the land.
I think you should. And so, if you want to break the bunch and then ask us to build Christmas to Brown and Christians afterwards, quite a logical idea.
Just do that.
Contain modifications to the airport zone. There was the inclusion of the structure plan A provisions, and I set those out at the end of this statement. They include a brief statement of in the zone purpose policy of the spoke structure plan that recognises the opportunities inherent in the land in the landscape context and rules relating to the activities in the structure plan. The activities enabled in the structure plan are as for the airport zone at Waikato Airport, in Table 1 of the airport zone rules, and they are airport activities and airport related activities that comply with the relevant standards which are permitted. And that list there in the second bullet point, which are all permitted, and then buildings which are controlled. The structure plan A provisions also provide for a limited amount of visitor accommodation outside of the out of control boundary, and I address that further shortly. In the airport zone, there is some listed prohibited activities, and any other activity is not compliant. And airport activity, by definition, means land use wholly for the landing, departure, and service movement of aircraft, including aircraft operations, servicing, training, associated offices, runways, taxiways, aprons, hangars, air traffic control, navigation, safety aids, car parking, fuel storage, refueling, and facilities for hazardous substances. An airport-related activity is an ancillary activity or service that provides support to an airport, including land transit activities, buildings and structures, servicing and infrastructure, police stations, fire stations, medical facilities, education facilities that serve an aviation-related purpose, retail and commercial services and industry associated with the needs of airport passengers, visitors and employees, and or aircraft movements and airport businesses, catering facilities, quarantine and incineration, border control, immigration facilities, admin offices, ancillary to the activities and farming. The two sets of activities are defined separately, and the distinction between them is locational. An airport activity is either an airside activity, like a runway, or in almost all cases requires an airside location. An airport-related activity does not necessarily need to be airside, as evidenced at and near many other airports, as I discussed in my primary evidence. The ASCRL report indicates that 32 hectares of additional land is needed at Waikato Airport for mainly airside activities over a planning horizon of 40 years. ASCRL's assessment has not factored in the kinds of airport-related activities that do not require an airside location, but nevertheless need to be at or close to the airport, including those associated with scheduled air transport services, freight and logistics, storage, airline catering, related offices, airmen, compatible visitor accommodation, and so on. The QAC now supports JBIL's proposal for complementary uses established within JBIL land, and this support from the letter has four caveats, which I comment on. Firstly, noise-sensitive activities are to be excluded. No residential or other sensitive activities are provided for in structure plan A area except for a small-scale VA. VA that would be complementary to the airport because it would be outside the out-of-control boundary and would serve those who benefit from staying close to the airport, in particular, for example, pilots, mechanics and others who are directly involved in airport operations. And the structure plan A area contains land outside the OCB, which allows for this. development to be sympathetic to the landscape, and the structural plan provisions address this as discussed by Ms. Kogras. The development should consider airport operations. The provisions exclude sensitive activities except for the VA outside the OCB and include activities that are connected to the airport. And finally, the development should be a safe pedestrian vehicular connection between the airport and the site, and that's your discussion with Mr. Carr. The airport's gravity has attracted various non-airport activities, including, for example, a toy museum, a brewery, and the Habershop operation on the JVIL land. These benefit from the airport's role as a destination for visitors, consumer flights and so on, and the activities feed off each other. The physical outcome has been a consolidation of development in and nearby the airport. Ms. Banks considers that Mr. Carr's traffic assessment has underestimated development capability in the structural plan A area, and I disagree with that. The calculations are shown in Appendix B of Ms. Snodgrass' primary evidence. The maximum total building area is around 5.5 hectares, and Commissioner Hudson, I did mention that in my evidence in chief, paragraph 3.5A, where I talked about the total area and the discounts to arrive at a building coverage of use of hectares, not square metres. That 5.5 hectares translates to a total building coverage of 38% across the structure plan area, across the whole of the area, which then translates to 52.9%, or so 50% coverage and gross floor area when it's translated on a per lot basis. And just to explain that, by the time we've taken out roading the landscape preservation area, we're left with less land, and on a per lot basis, which is far easier from a rules administration point of view, that comes out to be 50% rather than trying to express it as 38% across the whole zone. And that allows for one story development only, and it's expressed rather than coverage, I've expressed it as a gross floor area. And if you turn to the rules, and on page 7, there's a new rule I've added, 17.5.15, which is maximum gross floor area, 50% of lot area. And this is in response to Ms. Banks' concern and Mr. Carr's response to that, which has the limitation on the traffic and the flows at the intersection, so that then feeds back into what can actually happen at the site, and that translates into a 50% gross floor area of a lot. And that effectively allows for one story development only. So if someone wants to have two stories, they would have to have less coverage. Or four stories, even less coverage than that. So I've included a rule in the provisions accordingly, and allows for a gross floor area of 50% with non-compliant status for a breach to recognise the traffic implications. Mr. Barr criticises the proposed zoning on several grounds, which I address now. Firstly, lack of substantive growth information and sufficient land capacity already. Mr. Barr's view is that there is enough land within QAC's ownership to accommodate the foreseeable growth of the airport. My view is that the land ownership is not relevant to addressing the land needs. The relevant factors are location and other attributes of the land, whether there are any constraints to zoning, such as traffic or landscape factors, and whether there are any other externalities, such as retail distribution effects on the town centre. Now, I guess town centre effects further below, and in relation to traffic and landscape effects, and reliance on Mr. Carr and Ms. Snodgrass, development in accordance with Structure Plan A is acceptable, in my view. Secondly, the land would be sporadic development and cause sprawl along the road. And I disagree with Mr. Barr that the Structure Plan A development would be sporadic or cause sprawl along roads. The Structure Plan A consolidates the airport development and takes into account the amenity as viewed from the highway and prevents ad hoc development that would, in my view, would inevitably rise in the rural zone because of the attraction of the airport. And further, there would be around 2 kilometres of airport development along the north side of the highway before the QAC's lane was developed. I do agree with Mr. Barr's concern about the potential for precedent in relation to land on the opposite side of Barker Road, Mount Barker Road, but I consider that land is also captured by the airport's attraction. and may be the subject of future applications, and so suffers from potential precedent effects anyway. The existence of structure plan A might add to that potential, but I do not consider that that is sufficient reason to reject structure plan A. There is no proposal for rezoning now, and any application would need to be tested on its merits under the rural zone provisions. And I guess it would be a brave person to attempt that in light of the stop and break decision. It would need to look at the purely sensitive development given the controls or the corridor issues raised in that decision. Finally, adverse effects on Wanaka Town Centre. As I addressed above, there was a range of non-airside activities, including many airport-related activities, and those that complement the airport and benefit from close proximity to it, but which are not provided for or are not an appropriate fit elsewhere. And these include, for example, the Toy Museum and the Habershop operations. These latter activities have been present at the airport for many years, but would be non-complying in the airport zone, including in the Structure Plan A area. I've contemplated whether such activity should be provided for by a specific rule in the Structure Plan A area, but considered that the catch-all non-complying status is the most appropriate, so that any proposed activity is tested as to its effects and how it bears under the objectives and policies of the airport zone and the higher order chambers. And the airport zone contains the following policies, and I'll let you read those that are to do with impacts elsewhere, particularly on the Wanaka Town Centre. And it's the policy that gives rise to the restrictions on retail and food and beverage facilities. These are more appropriate for the Structure Plan A area than the rural objectives and policies, in my view, because they focus attention on the relationship with the airport, which is the key reason for my support for the Structure Plan A area. The policies apply across the airport zone, including for the QAC land. The QAC land is more appropriate for airside activities, but for airport-related activities and for any other activity that may attempt to pass the Section 104D tests, both the QAC and the Structure Plan A areas are appropriate. I therefore consider Mr. Barr's concerns about the potential effects of activities on the town centre zone unfounded. The objectives and policies are sufficiently robust to test any proposal for the outside expected airport zone activities, regardless of location in the airport zone. So, general comments in conclusion, I consider that the zone change is appropriate as the Structure Plan A land is a much stronger association with the airport than with the growth of Crooked Farm, as you've heard from the balance. That if it is not owned by QSC should not be a consideration because it is suitable for airport related activities and possibly for other activities that benefit from the relationship with the airport. As I indicated in my primary evidence, there are many examples of airports and environs with airport and related activities that do not require an airside location and for which separation from the airport by a road is not an impediment. The objectives and policies of the airport zone are more suitable for the JVIL land than those of the rural zone. Activities that seek an airport location are able to be accommodated in a structured manner rather than an ad hoc manner that would arise in the rural zone. I therefore maintain my view that the Structure Plan A provisions are appropriate and consistent with the Mr. Barr's principles for considering the various rezoning requests, the higher order provisions of the PDP and Part 2. A couple of other matters, sir. In question to Ms. Snodgrass about four-storey buildings, that's possible, but with the gross floor area rule, that would reduce the coverage of the building accordingly. And one of the original reasons for having four-storey buildings was things like the entry level for storage and logistics type buildings, which would need a high height even though they would only have one level. So it may not be more than one storey. That could be, but if there is, then that's not going to have any impact on the gross floor area overall. Secondly, I advised the owner of Leigh Mackay Station about an underpass, and the NZTA readily granted an underpass for farming because the Leigh Mackay Station straddles the highway. There's parts of it to the west of the highway and to the east of the highway near Luggett. And I'm not ever sure if the underpass went in, but its proposed location was...
Yes, that's the first side.
Right. It's a near place to the hill.
Thank you very much, Mr. Brown. I said we'll come back to questions at 1 o'clock.
Yes.